kissed your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life. From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we are continuing with a special original in-depth investigative reporting series, Fascism in America. Joining me shortly will be Representative Alan Grayson. He is a member of the House of Representatives from Florida's 9th Congressional District and one of the few remaining authentic progressive voices remaining in Congress. He has been Congress's most fierce critic of private contractor fraud in Iraq and the Federal Reserve. He is also an outspoken supporter for a public Medicare program for all citizens. He has the honor of passing more amendments than any other of his peers in Congress and was voted by the slate as the most effective member of our federal legislature. And during his earlier term, initiated the War Is Making You Poor Act in Congress that would have removed and cut taxes for the most needy in our society. And we'll be going to him in a moment. I'm told he's on the line right now, so let's say hello to Representative Alan Grayson. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm very concerned about what I see and the listeners in this audience see is a shift from our legislative process, and hence the legislators, working on behalf of their constituents' interests and instead working on behalf of the lobbyist and multinational interest with some devastating impact. And I'd like to go through some of these with you and have you give us your perspective. For example, after the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act replaced Glass-Steagall, separating savings and loan banks from speculative trading, there has been an increase in the large banks moving into non-financial commercial enterprises and commodities. Now, I read your letter to Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve, and I was surprised to know that Morgan Stanley imported 4 million barrels of oil and petroleum into the United States last year alone. The same bank is expanding operations and ownership in airports, toll roads, and seaports. Goldman Sachs stores aluminum in large warehouses to manipulate its commodity derivative trading. J.P. Morgan has been marketing public utilities like electricity in California. Last year, the 10 largest global banks generated $6 billion in revenues from commodity trading. And I'm sure there are many other examples. And heaven forbid the banks move into the privatization of water, which they may very well do. And there's also the flip side with large businesses such as Walmart offering credit and savings accounts and CDs to customers. So would you first explain to us the big bank's primary rationale for this rapid expansion into commercial and commodity products? And how does this make our economic system more unstable? And what is its financial impact upon the average citizen? And then secondly, what efforts are being made to reinstate the principles of Glass-Steagall? And where is the greatest opposition coming from?
Well, thanks for a very sophisticated and intelligent question. I do a lot of these interviews, and I have to tell you that very few interviewers are as well prepared as you are when it comes to a question like that. With regard to what the motivation is for Wall Street to do things like this, to get into commodities trading, buying and selling of a public utility like water and so on, their rationale is very simple. It's greed. They feel that that's a way that they can make more money. The problem with that is that they control our system of credit. And the function of the banking system is to allocate credit, not to use up credit themselves. For starters, Wall Street now has access to money borrowed from the Federal Reserve. You can't borrow from the Federal Reserve. I can't borrow from the Federal Reserve. Even General Motors can't borrow from the Federal Reserve or Microsoft or Google. But Wall Street can borrow from the Federal Reserve and borrow at rates as low as less than a quarter of 1% a year. We allow that because the Federal Reserve controls the money supply. And the credit that's made available is supposed to work its way through the banks and get in the hands of people and business concerns and be used to invest and expand operations. What's happening is that the banks on Wall Street are short-circuiting that process and using Federal Reserve credit, cheap Federal Reserve credit, to directly expand their own operations and to provide unfair competition to other private enterprise. Secondly, banks have what are called fractional reserves. Typically, an organization, whether on Wall Street or a community bank, has only a small fraction of the actual cash involved in its operations and has something like 10 to 1 debt. In other words, for every dollar of equity in a Citibank or Goldman Sachs, there's $10 of borrowed money. A very unstable situation, except for the fact that these entities are regulated, and they're regulated for the sake of trying to prevent them from collapsing. The regulation extends to things like the way that they extend credit to their customers. It can't possibly extend to things like copper trading, which is completely outside of the area expertise of every bank regulator in existence. So because of these are inherently fragile institutions that must be regulated, otherwise they will go bust. And as soon as they get away from banking and use their subsidized lending from the Federal Reserve and employ that in businesses other than lending, they become essentially impossible to regulate, and therefore they're destined for failure.
I appreciate that oversight. Thank you. I have a concern about how our government has chosen to view we the people, all of us, no exceptions, as potential targets. Somehow they view us as a threat, yet they have not explained this, not the president nor any of the members of Congress, as to why you and I should have our emails, our private chats, our correspondence monitored. And first they lied about it, now we know the truth. And then we did some investigation, and we found out that the legislators who are supporting this and voted actually against a bill that would have limited that, received the largest amount of money from defense contractors, including defense contractors that are part of the spy business. Then when I went through the profit-driven defense contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton and Boeing, they get the largest single percentage of the government surveillance efforts. And according to The Nation, the evidence suggests that recipients of defense contractor cash are more likely to vote in support of the National Security Agency's policies. And this is what makes the NSA debate very difficult from other recent high-profile battles over privacy, like the Stop Online Privacy Act. Now, in that situation, you had big technology firms helping to fund the advocacy against SOPA, which critics charge would lead to online censorship. And the technology companies were worried that SOPA would cost them money, so they lobbied against it and helped organize the public to defeat the legislation. So here we have the American public being spied upon. Here we have an enormous new bureaucracy, the spy complex. And once you start these agencies, they don't get smaller. They get larger, and once something is an emergency short term, it becomes permanent. It becomes embedded into the psyche of Washington. What are your thoughts on how far the government is going in intruding into our privacy?
Well, just to make sure that your listeners understand the facts that we're talking about here, in March, the National Intelligence Director, James Clapper, said to in public in a congressional hearing before the Senate that the intelligence agencies, the Defense Department and so on, were not maintaining any records that covered millions of Americans. That led the whistleblower Snowden to release information showing that that was false testimony. Ironically, we later found out that Clapper knew it was false, and that the day after he'd given that testimony, a staffer from Clapper's office contacted the senator's office, the senator to ask that question, told him that Clapper knew his answer was false, also told him that the correction was classified and that he was not allowed to inform the public that Clapper was calling to correct his testimony. That understandably led Snowden and a number of other people, apparently, to be up in arms about the public and the Congress being misinformed. Therefore, an order was leaked that demonstrated that Verizon, and we later found out other telephone companies, essentially every other telephone company, was being ordered to turn over information about every telephone call that Verizon carried to the NSA on a real-time basis, day by day. So every time you make a call now, within 24 hours, the NSA, part of the Defense Department, gets a record of that call. There was some initial attempted explanations that they were looking for patterns. It turned out that that was utterly false, that they weren't looking for patterns at all. What they were doing was basically creating this giant, vast database. Then there was a claim that it was limited to only our telephone calls. That turned out to be false. Just this past week, we found out that it extends to emails, online storage, when you log on and off your computer, possibly even your location through the location systems that exist in your phone and your computer that are built into them, and so on. So we have, at this point, had disclosed to us, and this is a revelation even to members of Congress, believe me, that there is pervasive domestic surveillance that conceitedly at least covers every phone call that everyone makes, including, by the way, this one, when I call you. Within 24 hours, the NSA will have a record of the fact that I called your show, the fact that the number I called from, the number that received the call, how long the call lasted, and so on. There has been a claim that somehow this is necessary to make us safe, and I think that that's utter fiction. I've listened very carefully to the arguments both for and against. I don't want people to be in any danger. I think that it's farcical to claim that we need 100% domestic surveillance in order to keep us safe from a bunch of foreign terrorists. You know, going back to the 1870s, we draw this very clear line between the Defense Department defending us from foreign threats and the Justice Department and later the FBI and domestic law enforcement, like police officers, protecting us from domestic threats. The NSA has erased that line. They've obliterated it. They've said that every domestic activity by every American citizen falls within their purview. And it's exactly what you say. It's not so much that you're guilty until you're proven innocent. You're guilty regardless. You can prove yourself innocent all you want, and they're still going to track all your phone calls.
I've been an activist my entire adult life. I've written many books. I've produced over 100 documentaries on themes that are important for the public, social issues. Virtually every activist, every person that protests anything against corporate America or the government is now considered suspect. It goes even further. The FBI now has mandated that if you take any recording or still photograph or report information on animal abuse from a factory farm, you can be arrested, you will then be deemed a terrorist instead of the perpetrator of a crime against an animal. Now, this is in no small measure because of something that's been going on for a long time that we didn't know about. We suspected it, but we had no proof of it. And that was, at the state level, bills were being introduced by a consortium of about 300 major corporations that we worked in unison. It was called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This is the latest report. 71 ALEC bills this year alone will make it harder to hold corporations accountable for causing injury or death. That's just this year. There's also another 77 ALEC bills this year advancing big oil and big agriculture's benefits and renewable energy standards, supporting hydrofracking, the controversial Keystone Pipeline, and otherwise undermine all environmental laws that were introduced in 34 states just this year. Now, that's the newest analysis from the Center for Media and Democracy. And they took a look at all the ALEC bills. Who would have known, for example, that the people supporting tar sands were ALEC, so that they made sure in the states that the pipeline went through, there wouldn't be a problem. And this is true of virtually everything. Also, ALEC agenda tips the scales of justice to help corporations win. For decades, ALEC has been a conduit for the oil, tobacco, pharmaceutical industries to push legislation that changes the rules to limit accountability when a corporation's product or actions cause injury or death, such as the Koch brothers industry pipeline that explodes and kills teenagers, or when the tobacco or pharmaceutical industries withhold evidence of their products being dangerous. In just this first 6 months, these are the bills of tort reform goals that were introduced. So now we know that behind the scenes, in every state, there's a legion of lobbyists that are meeting on a regular basis with our state legislators and giving them total that we have been able to document 22,000 laws have been passed in the last 35 years that were ALEC-based laws behind the scenes. So how fair is it when we elect someone to a state office and then they pass a law that the average citizen is not aware of, and then that protects the corporate interest and undermines our safety, our food safety, our body safety, our capacity to challenge. And yet this is now so common, it can't even be hidden. Your thoughts on ALEC and the usurping of our constitutional rights by major corporations.
Well, ALEC is an abomination, and ALEC is the institutionalization of rule by special interests, and specifically rule by business interests and rule by greed. It used to be that the businesses had to hire individual lobbyists in order to get their tax break or in order to get their zoning change or in order to get their bailout or in order to get their no-bid contract. What ALEC has done is it's decided to avoid the need to do that retail, because ALEC provides that same function wholesale. It does it for business interests across the board generically. And, you know, I don't want this to turn into some kind of partisan rant, but I will tell you that ALEC works closely with the Republican Party. The Republican Party has become, in essence, ALEC's left hand and ALEC's right hand. ALEC works at the state level in order to pass bills that are fundamentally contrary to public interest, to the interest of the public and the community, localities. You know, recently ALEC arranged to squelch an effort in my county, Orange County, to have paid sick leave by passing a bill through the state legislature that dictated that my county could not choose to have paid sick leave. They consider it to be anti-business to have paid sick leave, even if people wanted it and voted for it democratically. And this is what you see all around the country. The Republican Party has become callous, indifferent to the needs of ordinary people, and has become a tool of special interests. I'm not saying that Democrats are innocent. I'm not saying that at all. We have our own problem with our new Democrats and so on. But in the case of the Republican Party, it's a uniform support for whatever nonsense ALEC flings at them and orders them to pass. But ALEC, in a sense, has just been doing the work that the Chamber of Commerce has been doing for much longer than that. ALEC simply is, in essence, the lawmaking element of the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce in Central Florida has itself become simply a device to extract money out of the taxpayers' pockets and to defeat democratic government. The chamber spent over $1 million to try to defeat me in 2008, in 2010, and then $500,000 to try to defeat me last year. And in essence, what we're seeing is an excess of selfish private interests who are using the power of money and flaws in our electoral process to take over the government and change this from a democracy to a corporocracy.
I would agree with that. Let me give you two examples of how I see this and see if you concur. ALEC presented 117 different bills this year that would cause wages and workers' rights to be diminished. They were behind the right to work law in Lansing, Michigan. But also, when you look at the latest unemployment statistics, they are deceptive. First, they do not include people who are part-time or just marginal time. They're considered working. So we did an analysis, a very careful and scholarly analysis of the over 800,000 jobs that had been occurred. 80% were part-time work. Now, within that part-time work, these are low-end part-time work. These are people and many college kids who are working at jobs they weren't, quite frankly, they cannot support a standard of living. They're still living at home. In fact, more than 41% of all graduates who are male are living back with their parents. Then you have this statistics. This is from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. This is new today. That the number of children living in families with incomes below the official poverty level rose to 16.4 million. In fact, the latest study shows that more than one in four children in America under five, that's 26%, were officially poor this year. And the increases in child poverty continued well after Obama's declared officially that the recession was ended. So he may say the recession's ended, but being poor in America has not ended. One-third of American children live in households without secure employment, meaning no parent has full-time or year-round employment. That's up from 27% in 2008. And it means that right now, as you and I are speaking, 18 million people from 1 to 18 years of age are going to bed hungry. They do not have adequate nutrition. 1.5 million children walk out of school each day and have no home to return to. They're living in cars or living with relatives. 44 million Americans are living outside of their original home or domicile because they do not have that home, yet they are not shown anywhere. They are invisible. 16 million senior citizens are living at or below the poverty level. They're invisible. So I'm concerned that in Congress, where we have unlimited amounts of money for wars or continuing to support Afghan governments which are corrupt, Iraq governments which are corrupt, expanding wars elsewhere, expanding our military-industrial spy complex, we have no problem paying those bills. I'm concerned what is being done by members of Congress to at least acknowledge that we have 18 million hungry children, 1.5 homeless million homeless school kids, and 100 million Americans living just about above, below, or at the poverty level. Nothing I can see is being done to change that. Your thoughts, please.
Sad but true. It's something that grinds on me almost every day. Our priorities are utterly twisted and perverted by the power of money. The reason why people say the recession is over is because the recession is over for the 1% at the top. For everyone else, people continue to struggle and continue to fail, to drop out of the middle class. You know, to be in the middle class in America, you need a job, a full-time job. You need a home. You need some kind of health care, access to health care. You need a car. You need some kind of basis for thinking that you'll have a reasonable retirement. Otherwise, you'll end up working until you die. And all of those things are either ignored or even they're under attack. Just yesterday, Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House, said that he would be willing to end the sequester if we cut Social Security and Medicare, as if that's a good thing. And it's very discouraging because those of us who have had hard times in our lives, and I'm one of them, those of us who have had hard times in their lives understand that there's a human price to be paid for organizing society around the benefit of the extremely wealthy, plus whatever dress Paris Hilton happens to be wearing today. And meaningless weapons of mass distraction like that that take people away from the hard and rough and difficult realities that you just described in people's everyday lives. And the things that you just described should be the center of our attention, and they are not. The campaign finance system has perverted rule and governance to chasing $5,000 checks from special interests. Virtually every member of Congress sees most of their contributions for their reelection campaigns from either business PACs or from the extremely rich, millionaires and multimillionaires and even billionaires, like the Koch brothers, who inject hundreds of millions of dollars into every campaign cycle to put out their right-wing propaganda and to choose people who are going to serve Alex's function and do Alex's bidding, both at the federal level and the state level. And it's terrible. I mean, when I was going through school, I worked as a night watchman. I cleaned toilets for a while. I know what it is to have to work and struggle. And I feel sorry for the unnecessary pain that's inflicted because we have the wrong priorities here. You could take literally one third of the defense budget that we voted on 2 weeks ago in Congress. You could take one third of that and you could provide a job to every American who is unemployed, every single American. And I'm not talking about this 5% figure that passes for full employment. I'm talking about driving unemployment all the way down to zero and providing people with jobs that would take them out of poverty. And instead, we have something on the order of 20 million people in this country who can't find full-time work. It's probably larger than that, actually. It's probably closer to 30 million. We have a staggering number of people who find full-time work and end up working for a pittance, not enough to take them out of poverty if they work 40 hours a week or more. If you work 40 hours a week at the minimum wage, you are nowhere near high enough to be above the poverty line. You're nowhere near that. That's why I introduced a bill to raise the minimum wage to $10.50 an hour, which is where it was in 1968 in terms of purchasing power. Now it's much lower than where it was in 1968, despite the enormous increases in productivity, the development of computers, the internet, and so on. We're actually lower now in minimum wage than we were then. In Australia, the minimum wage is $16 an hour, and Australia has 5% unemployment. Here, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And America has 7.5% unemployment. And it's the price that we pay for simply having the wrong priorities. We spend as much on defense as virtually every other country in the world combined, our so-called defense. Part of that is the effort that we spend spying upon ourselves, having the Defense Department spy upon ourselves. We spend billions and billions of dollars on that every year to spy upon ourselves, when we could be taking that money and putting people back to work and taking care of our children. As you point out, children are very disproportionately affected by poverty, far, far more children in poverty than adults. And we could do that to meet our human needs, you know, to have seniors taken care of, to have children taken care of, to have the sick taken care of. And in fact, what we do is we have the seniors live in some cases, at the very edge of poverty, surviving on nothing but Social Security. We have children living in cars, living with relatives who are not their parents because there's no money to take care of them. And we have, in many cases, a poor education system that's getting worse year after year after year. And we have 50 million people in this country who can't see a doctor when they're sick. And, you know, I struggle as best I can. And I'm not the only one. I mean, for 3,000 years, we've known that a just society is one that shelters the homeless and feeds the hungry and heals the sick. So what I try to do every day is simply a reflection of those 3,000-year-old priorities. But it's an uphill battle because money has the power.
You're right. I appreciate all your efforts. You have a law degree from Harvard College and a Harvard Law School and John F. Kennedy School of Government, and you were a prosecutor. I only have two more questions for you, but one of them is a large question because it's not being addressed in our society. You end up looking at money laundering and the global drug trade, and they're fueled by some elites. When they're caught and the Justice Department has them, like Wachovia and some of the other banks that were known for funneling hundreds of billions of dollars through their accounts, they're given a small fine relative to the amount of money they made, less than 6%. and what represents about a three-week income for the bank. And so it's supposed to be a big penalty. But I'm thinking, if you or I were caught engaged in money laundering as individuals, we would go to jail. I then decided to do a review, and it took me 14 months. And here's what I did. I simply hired some lawyers, and I asked them, young lawyers, and I said, how many lawsuits have been settled on by Wall Street banks for actions that were brought by state or federal authorities, not individuals? And then I took a look at pharmaceutical companies. How many pharmaceutical companies have settled actions for wrongful death or injury or insider trading or lying or deceptive practices? And about 9 months later, they brought in these huge crates. And I said, what's this? They said, this is just the summaries. I said, well, how many of them are there? Oh, over 400,000 lawsuits. I said, you're kidding. Totaling hundreds of billions of dollars. And then they showed me, I said, well, just give me the top 20 laws, top 20 banks on Wall Street and the top 20 pharmaceutical companies. Every single major bank on Wall Street, every single major pharmaceutical company was just steeped in lawsuits where wrongful death, where the results show they knew that they were marketing a bad drug like Vioxx that killed 60,000 Americans. But when they settled the lawsuit for $5.45 billion, the stock value went up that afternoon. The president of the company got a raise. And I thought to myself, where else could you kill 60,000 people and get a raise? And then over on Wall Street, every one of these banks were found guilty of all forms of schemes and paid astronomical amounts of money. But no one went to jail. No one's reputation was adversely affected. The government continued to do business with Halliburton and others that have been shown to intentionally, with malice aforethought, to engage in illegal activities, price rigging and selling us defective equipment, etc., in Iraq and Afghanistan, for example. And I'm thinking,
soldiers in their showers.
How is this possible that we're dealing not with a few, not a few rotten apples, but the entire group are this corrupt, and yet we do not call them out? The media still values them. They're still on all the talk shows, on the financial shows, and yet no one says, look at your ethics, look at your morality, look at what you've done to people and all these other things. And the fact that you haven't spent a day in jail doesn't mean that you're not morally reprehensible. I was just amazed at how corrupt these people are, and yet these are the people who can walk into the White House or other places to have a conversation with a legislator or a president or top of the media, and they get their way. Different set of laws for them, different set of rules of conduct, different set of outcomes than for you or I. Could you address this, please?
Well, honestly, it's a very deep-rooted problem that goes back a long way. If you look back at Hammurabi's code, the first code of law that stretches back over 2,000 years, substantially more than 2,000 years ago, you'll find that in Hammurabi's code, there was one rule for the rich and one rule for the poor, literally, explicitly. The penalties were different under Hammurabi's code depending upon whether you're rich or poor. And we have institutionalized that in our legal system. It is a tremendous problem, first of all, that corporations, which are a relatively new phenomenon, I mean, only in the past 150 years have they been a substantial part of people's lives. Corporations are not easy to discipline. They live forever. You can't put them in prison. And they treat fines, which is essentially the only way to punish them at this point under our law, as a cost of doing business. They literally do a cost-benefit analysis of whether it's profitable for them to commit crimes or not. And more often than not, it is. First of all, they hardly ever get caught. Secondly, when they get caught, they can make every conceivable legal argument because they have armies of lawyers they throw into the breach. And third, on those rare occasions when they're actually brought to something resembling justice, like the instances that you described, they end up paying the fine, and for them, life goes on. and nothing has happened. There's been proposals that if a corporation is found guilty of a certain number of crimes, then the corporation should be disbanded. Maybe those are things we should look at more closely. They're regarded as a function of state law rather than federal law, and the states that placate the corporations the most, Delaware, Nevada, and so on, they're the ones that end up having companies incorporate in them. So there's a built-in protection for them even in that regard. I have done, I think, a very substantial act in now passing what we call the corporate death penalty for government contractors who cheat the government and cheat the public. I'm very concerned about the fact that you can do what you do as a corporation, end up paying the fine, and then for you, life goes on and you continue to get taxpayer money. And we've introduced my corporate death penalty provision now in several different bills, and it's passed. So as we work our way through the different federal agencies, what we're doing is establishing a rule that says that if you are found guilty of bribery, if you're found guilty of embezzlement, if you're found guilty of fraud, we have a list of 12 of these crimes, then you lose your government contracts for 3 years. And constitutionally, that's probably as far as the courts will allow us to push it. But if it were up to me, I'd say that you lose your government contracts forever. I don't understand why taxpayers should be subsidizing corporate entities that have been found guilty of, in many cases, you described, literally killing people. They may live forever. We don't. And yet when they inflict that sort of pain on individuals, pain to the point of death, they can continue with their infinite lives and continue to get government contracts and everything else. So the short answer is, I think we've made, in our case, we've made some progress to try to turn things around and to grapple with the underlying problem that you're describing, which is the fact that the corporations as entities have no conscience and they're very difficult to discipline.
My final question for you begins with a short piece, a commentary from Professor Richard Falk. He is the Albert Millbrook Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University. He is also the Distinguished Professor in Global and International Studies, University of California, Santa Barbara. Here's what he says, and I'm very interested in your response. I'll quote this. What am I missing in the Snowden affair? The U.S. government's dogmatic pursuit of Snowden is both counterproductive and hypocritical. The U.S. government's position contradicts its own long-standing practice of refusing to give up those wanted for political crimes. I would have thought that there was a clear set of principles that make the American diplomatic pursuit of Edward Snowden as a refuge from justice a rather empty and futile gesture. As far as I can tell, there is not even a need for asylum, as governments should have been prepared to grant Snowden resident status because his alleged criminal acts in the United States were without question political crimes without violence or monetary motivation. I had thought it was clear as law can be that any person who has committed a political crime should be exempted from mandatory extradition, even if a treaty existed imposed a duty on its parties to hand over individuals accused of serious criminal activity. To be sure, from the perspective of the United States government, Snowden's exposure, the PRISM surveillance program was a flagrant violation of the Espionage Act. But it was also as clearly a political crime as almost any undertaking can be. There's no violence involved or threatened, and no person could be harmed by the disclosures. What puzzles me is why the refusal to hand Snowden over by expelling him to the United States, which is what Washington has asked Russia to do, raises any kind of serious question beyond wondering how the U.S. government officials arrogantly made the request in the first place. As it was put to Moscow by the U.S. government, quote, we expect the Russian government to look at all options available to expel Snowden. It was also puzzling why foreign governments do not make this simple point in response to international criminal law. Enforcement does not extend to political crimes, even in the relation of the governments friendly with one another. Now, here's where it gets interesting, and this is the central point. Quote, the United States government's position contradicts its own long-standing practice of refusing to give up those wanted for political crimes, including in some instances even shielding persons charged with terrorist activity. The most notorious example is that of Luis Posado Carreras, an exile from Cuba with a long record of involvement in the anti-Castro terrorist activity, alleged to have blown up a Cuban passenger plane in 1976 with 73 people on board and living without legal difficulties in Florida. This makes it a particularly dismaying moment when the government of France, Portugal, Spain, and Italy denied overflight rights to the plane carrying Evo Morales, president of Bolivia, apparently hoping to persuade a friendly government to seize Snowden if he were on board. It should hardly be surprising that such diplomatic hardball at Bolivia's expense angers Latin American countries, justifiably sensitive about the U.S. willingness to encroach upon their sovereign rights in a manner that would not be tolerated if the situation were reversed. Undoubtedly, an anguishing reminder that the mentality that bestowed the Monroe Doctrine and the gumboat diplomacy on the Western Hemisphere is not entirely a thing of the past. Snowden himself shifted the context from the exemption of political crimes to asylum, which presupposes a justifiable fear of persecution of return to the country of nationality. Now, then it says this, and this was something we should remember. It talks about reciprocity and look at all of those individuals in, I'm summarizing now, look at all those individuals who participated in acts of terror from Iran-Contra in Venezuela, in Dominican Republic, in Bolivia, in Argentina, and Brazil for over a period of 20 years, all with the support of the United States, frequently trained at the Academy of the Americas, and yet they were never allowed, not one of them, to be extradited to their home country after a democracy was reestablished and they were held accountable. They still, and to this day, remain safe in the United States. So my question is, and that of Professor Falk, is how is it that we can look at our own history of protecting people who have taken shelter in the United States, even those that are suspected of having hurt people, killed people, engaged in terrorist activity, but did so through one of our governmental agencies or supporting our international diplomatic initiatives, and yet we expect others to immediately turn over Snowden. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, those decisions are made directly at the top, and I think that the president, to an unfortunate degree, has become tone-deaf on this issue. The president has become a very strong proponent of pervasive domestic spying, even though the president taught constitutional law and therefore must have some degree of familiarity with the Fourth Amendment. He's the leader of my party. He is the president of the United States. I have a fair amount of respect for him, and I'm reluctant to criticize him unless I think it's very much deserved. But in this case, I think it is deserved. The president is deciding to attack Snowden in order to distract us from the real and important underlying issues. And I remember feeling proud when 4 years ago, the president won the Nobel Peace Prize. The stated basis for the president winning the Nobel Peace Prize was then the president was changing forms of international discourse from dictating on the part of America to other countries what they must do and using force to back that up to a different kind of modus vivendi where we treat other sovereigns as being sovereign and we engage in discourse with them for the sake of the common good, the greatest good for the greatest number, wherever they happen to live and whatever their nationality happens to be. That's why the president won the Nobel Peace Prize. And yet here we are 4 years later. There's actually more American troops in Afghanistan today than there were when the president was sworn into office and assumed the responsibility as commander-in-chief. It's true that we've left military conflict in Iraq behind us, but only because the Iraqis insisted on it. The Iraqis gave us a specific deadline for getting the hell out. And we had no choice but to adhere to that deadline after they had created it and invoked it. And here in this situation, we have the United States government spying not only on its own people, but internationally, seemingly without any limits. Whatever limitations apply to the government listening to your calls and reading your emails does not apply, as far as the government's concerned, to anyone outside of the United States, any foreign citizens. So we have the government pervasively spying on the entire rest of the world and then acting as if it is the aggrieved party. When the whistleblower, who simply informs the country of the facts that are being concealed and lied about to Congress and to the American people by James Clapper and by others, they turn him into some kind of cause célèbre, when, in fact, this has almost nothing to do with Snowden. This has to do with our adhering to the Constitution of the United States and our adhering to basic principles of human dignity. The rest of the world is frankly appalled by the fact, first of all, that we spy on them, and secondly, that we claim to do it for their benefit. The rationale for this, when you actually talk to the people who are engaging in this, is not so much that it keeps us safe, but supposedly it thwarts terrorism in other countries. Well, if they feel that way about it, they can spy on each other. But in fact, we take it upon ourselves to spy upon them, and then claim that it's for their benefit, when in fact, they know it's not. So we reach this point now where Snowden is, in essence, a weapon of mass distraction. The discussion of Snowden, the relentless pursuit of Snowden, is simply the purpose of keeping us from talking about what really matters here, which is whether we have to spend billions upon billions upon billions of dollars to track every phone call that every American makes, to check out our emails, to check out our logging in and our logging off, to check the Google searches that we make, all in the sake of keeping us safe, and in the name of supposedly defeating a ragtag group of several hundred or maybe a couple of thousand foreigners called Al-Qaeda.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? I hope that at some point you consider starting a progressive party as an independent party and step away from the corporate Democrats, because you are a true progressive on all levels. And I certainly respect what you've done for the American people. And I want to thank you for taking your time today to come on and share your insights.
Thank you, too. I still have hope for the Democratic Party. Maybe we can make a lot of progress within the party. Honestly, some of the same impulses toward genuflection toward money exist among Democrats as they do among Republicans. But I think that we are establishing a new kind of way of doing the job. That's why I've been named the most effective member of Congress. That's why, among other things, we raise more money from small contributors at our Congressman with Guts website than any other member of Congress, Democrat or Republican. We actually were number one among small contributors in the last election cycle. And because of that, I have the freedom to say what's right and to treat the public as my constituency, the good people of Central Florida who elected me as my constituency, and not the Fortune 500 as my constituency.
We appreciate what you're doing, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for keeping the public informed. Have a good day.
Bye. Representative Alan Grayson, a member of the House of Representatives from Florida's 9th Congressional District and one of the few remaining authentic progressive voices remaining in Congress. And he is a fierce critic, as you heard, of private contractor fraud and the Federal Reserve. In the remainder of our program, I just want to give you an idea of the unintended consequences of power in the hands of a few, mainly corporations, how they get that power, and what it means to your eye. So it's not just about the Federal Reserve. It's not just about not going to jail for crimes that your company commits. But it's as simple as the food we eat. This is also an extension of fascism, where big government and those in the levers of power, the policymakers, and those in corporate America work together, serving each other's interest. And one day you end up having virtually exclusive control over the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the FDA. As a result, you end up putting out products into the marketplace, seeds, and pesticides and herbicides and fungicides that do not nurture the soil, that no one needs. No one in America wakes up saying, I want to eat a genetically engineered carrot today. There's never been a study that shows there's a benefit, no nutritional benefit at all, to genetic engineering. But let us look at something that Christina Sarich from Nation of Change discovered, and I thank her for doing that. What would happen if the genetic engineered seed and the pesticides end up killing off even more bees? Now, as a beekeeper and as a certified organic farmer and someone who understands the web of nature, I know how important bees are because they allow pollination. Many pesticides have been found to cause damage to bees, and that leads to what is called colony collapse. You start looking in states like Oregon, they have massive colony collapse. So you think, well, what's the big deal? I haven't seen a difference. So indeed, many parts of America, you won't see a difference because you're not getting your food from simply one place. I live on the Upper West Side. My office is at 83rd and Broadway, a central place on the Upper West Side, a 113-year-old building. And I walk everywhere, and I love the Upper West Side because it has a nice environment. Well, you walk by restaurants, they're filled. You walk by an outdoor produce stand, every imaginable type of food in and out of season is always there. In the wintertime, you'll see cherries from South Africa. You'll see peaches from Chile. So it would be different if you were in Oregon or some other states and you could only get what was locally grown. And then you would start hearing about the farmers who have tiny little fruit this year or only getting one-third the fruit or getting no fruit. Why? Because of bees. But because we end up getting concentrated amounts of produce from multiple different sources, not only in the United States, but all over the world, we don't see the shortages. Here's a list of the crops that are pollinated by bees. So let me put a point on this. We now know, without question, that bees are disoriented when they come into contact with different pesticides and they come back to the hive and die, or they fly back what is called poison drunk and they die in the hive, or they don't even know how to get back to the hive. They're so disoriented. And the major culprit are pesticides made by Monsanto and other companies. A study by the European Food Safety Authority has labeled one pesticide called clothianidin as completely unacceptable for use and banned it from use entirely. However, because of the politics of big business and ALEC and the Business Roundtable and the selections by Obama to the Department of Agriculture and the pro-GMO people in the FDA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, you won't see the same concerns in the United States as official policy about protecting us and our soil and crops and bees as you see in other countries. But the reality is this. The same pesticide use on more than one-third of all crops in the United States means 143 million acres are sprayed. Two more pesticides have been linked to bee death, and they're used in the United States, but not elsewhere. In fact, here's what could easily happen. In the very near future, we could have upwards of 90% nationwide bee collapse. In some states, in some bee farms, with upwards of 5,000 or 6,000 beehives, you have 90% collapse. So listen carefully to these foods, because these are the foods that can be diminished or eliminated with colony collapse that are pollinated by bees. This gives you an idea how important bees actually are. Apples, mangoes, rambutan, kiwi fruit, plums, peaches, nectarines, guava, rosehip, pomegranates, pears, black and red currants, alfalfa, okra, strawberries, onions, cashews, cactus, prickly pear, apricots, avocado, passion fruit, lima beans, kidney beans, adzuki beans, green beans, custard apples, cherries, celery, walnuts, cotton, lychee, flax, acerola, macadamia nut, sunflower, lemons, buckwheat, figs, fennel, limes, carrots, persimmons, loquat, cucumber, hazelnut, cantaloupes, tangelos, coriander, caraway, chestnuts, watermelons, star apples, coconut, tangerines, boysenberries, star fruit, Brazil nuts, beets, mustard seed, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, bok choy, turnips, Congo beans, sword beans, chili peppers, red peppers, green peppers, papaya, safflower, sesame, eggplant, raspberry, elderberries, blackberries, clover, tamarind, coca, black-eyed peas, vanilla, cranberries, tomatoes, and grapes. So, all those foods I just mentioned, those could all be diminished or eliminated if we continue to have colony collapse. And we will continue to have colony collapse because we have no one at the national level in our federal agencies looking after our interest. They're all looking after Monsanto and DuPont's interest. And that, to me, is just the unintended consequences of fascism that we never discuss. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. And we'll continue with this series on our next program. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about being driven to abstraction, the increasing uselessness of ideology, that some parts of our society are so gripped by ideology they forget about action. So that's where we're going today.
We look forward to it in a moment, Utrice Lead.